Welcome to the Voices Podcast, where we are elevating voices who are reimagining faith.
Any way that the very central event of Christianity seems to perpetuate violence or justify violence or give some kind of tacit approval of violence, that's really troubling for people. And I think rightly so.
My name is Gary, and thanks for joining us on the Voices Podcast. We don't have our normal partner in crime here, Kyle, because he's flying to Japan right now. So today it's just me, and I'm going to be chatting with Tony Jones. I'm super excited for you to hear from him. He has recently done some work on the atonement. What happened on the cross? What is the point of the cross? What's the power of the cross? How do we understand that? So his book that we're going to talk about in this episode is called Did God Kill Jesus? Are you intrigued? I bet you are based on that title. Amazing book. And I think it's going to be so helpful as many of us who are working through faith and reimagining something, maybe something more faithful to what we believe and feel about our modern world. I think this will be a very helpful read and conversation. So here is Tony. Enjoy. All right. So today on the Voices Podcast, we've got Tony Jones, the author of Did God Kill Jesus? Amazing book title, by the way.
Thanks. I'm good at titles.
Yeah, I can tell, man. So thanks for being on the show with us. And
yeah, for sure.
Why don't you just, let's just start out. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us some background and who are you? What do you do, man?
Well, I'm a Minnesotan.
Ooh, sorry about your Minnesota Wild, by the way.
Yeah, that was not a good deal. Yeah, I've lived here pretty much my whole life, except when I've gone away to school. I've gone away a couple times to school. And so I live very close to where I grew up and married, got three kids. I'm a theologian. I write books, which is what we're talking about today. I also work in publishing and I own a small business that where I run conferences through that business. And then I just got a few other side hustles that I'm always working on that keep me interested, always writing and doing different stuff.
Man, a little bit of everything, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I think if I had just one job, I'd probably go mental. So I try to keep it. I try to do many different things every day.
Right on, man. Well, dude, let's just jump right into the most recent publishing you've put out. Did God Kill Jesus? Tell us the story behind why you felt like this was a book that needed to be written and the inspiration for you.
Well, I had been writing about the atonement on my blog, and it had been getting a lot of really good feedback. Like, people were really intrigued by what I was writing. And it was funny. I just felt like all the stuff that had been written on the atonement was really academic in nature. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of like popular stuff that normal people could read. So I was just blogging through different ideas and different like theories of the atonement that had come down through the church history. And then after I wrote all those, I just tried this little publishing experiment where I like gathered up those blog posts and turned them into an ebook.
Okay.
And then published that ebook, like just published it on Amazon for the Kindle. And like it sold thousands of copies. Like, people were really intrigued by it.
Yeah.
And so then sometime after that, I was at a conference and Phyllis Tickle was speaking, and my agent, my literary agent, was also at this conference. And Phyllis started talking about the atonement and like the next big theological problem that we need to solve is the atonement, because we don't have a good theory of the atonement. And so my agent, she's sitting on the other side of the sanctuary from me, and we start texting each other back and forth like,
nice.
Oh my gosh, you know, I wrote this ebook and we should put together a book proposal. And I think I came up with the title for the book there in a text message to her.
Did you really?
Yeah. And so then it stuck, and you know, then it just takes a long time, because then I spent a few months working on a proposal gave it to her. She edited the proposal. Finally, she shops it around to publishers. And then that's when Harper One bought it. And then, you know, then it took me a year and a half to write the book.
Yeah.
And then it came out in 2015. So the book's been out for a couple of years. Yeah, it came out and then came out in paperback, I guess, about 6 months ago.
Yeah. Man, so, I mean, what I appreciate about, your book is, you know, if I think about my own story kind of going back, I didn't grow up in the church, and I went to this weekend retreat thing, which was a pretty typical kind of Protestant youth group deal. And they did the whole thing with the cross up front. They like nailed a flash paper to it and then it vanished. And what's so fascinating to me is like, I walked away from that terrified, like,
yeah,
what in the world was that? That it doesn't make sense to me. And then it was a few days later that I had my, you can call it salvation moment or came to faith or whatever. But it wasn't really about like the atonement or the cross for me. I just felt so much love. And so when I was reading your book, and it's something for me, I think over my journey that I've always been kind of fascinated, like, hold on a second. Even your title, like, did God kill his kid? Was that what this thing is? And that's supposed to be the thing that compels me. So what I love about your book is that, like you said, it's so readable, but you give so much history and context, and you just, you dove into it so well. So I just I loved it. So on that note, how about you just tell us about a few of the more predominant views of the atonement and walk us through that a little bit. And maybe I'll interrupt with a couple of questions along the way.
Sure, sure. Well, as I mean, as you probably know, that one, I'm guessing the one that you heard about on that weekend retreat that was so violent and crazy, that's the one that theologians call the penal substitutionary model of the atonement.
Okay.
And in, but in my book, like, I try to avoid all those heavy theological words. So I call it the payment model or the penalty model or the punishment model.
Yep.
So the what's basically behind that, it goes back to a guy named Anselm who lived about 1,000 years ago, and he was a theologian and a bishop, and he basically said, you know, by sinning, we took honor away from God. Like, we dishonored God, and therefore we were, it was almost like we were stealing. We're stealing from God because God deserves from us perfect honor all the time.
Yeah.
And by giving God anything less than that, we're taking something away that God deserves and should have. So then we need to pay God back.
Okay.
Because we've taken something from God. We've stolen God's honor. Well, we don't have enough money in our bank account to pay God back.
Dang it.
Right?
Yeah.
God looks around for somebody. Somebody's got to pay. Like, somebody pay it. You know what I'm saying? It's like mafia guy going from, like, going into the little bodega and being like shaking down the guy behind the cash register. Like, I don't have enough cash. Well, we're coming back tomorrow. You better have enough then.
Yeah.
Like, we don't care. We don't care where you get it. Just go get it. So then the guy goes out and he like goes to the track and bets on the horses, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, he's doing anything he can to get the money to pay because he can't pay because he doesn't have enough money to pay. Well, there's one person who does have enough money to pay. Jesus. So
yeah, thanks,
God.
Jesus
turns his eyes on Jesus, and Jesus makes the payment that we can't make, and that payment is a terrible death. I mean, that's how you pay for the dishonor you've done to God. So this Anselm dude came up with this payment model, and then you fast forward up in church history, and other people, like famous names like John Calvin, and then even later in in colonial America, Jonathan Edwards, people are making that theory of the atonement more about not just about a payment we owe, but like that somebody needs to be penalized. Somebody needs to be punished for that, for dishonoring God. So God will not be happy until someone's punished for that. And so that's the big one. That's the big one in American evangelicalism that most kids hear at, you know, Young Life camp this summer.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, where does it, you said it was in the around 1000 or 1100.
Yeah. Around there. Yeah.
Okay. So this got developed 1,000 years after this event. So like, Where does this come from?
I mean, if you were to ask proponents, modern day proponents of that version of the atonement, they would be like, oh, no, all the church fathers believe this. And then they would like find some quote from some church father to be like, see, he believed in substitution, that Jesus was substituted for us. And sure enough, because there are Bible verses to kind of imply that Jesus is a substitute for us. Yeah, it's not like it was completely absent in the early church, but it wasn't the way that people thought about the cross, that Jesus was a substitute because God was wrathful and demanded somebody pay up. That's just not how they thought about it. So where did it come from Anselm? Well, I mean, he was a constructive theologian. He made it up. And I don't say that in a pejorative way, you know, like theologians make stuff up because they read the Bible and they think rationally and they read philosophy.
Yeah.
But he was a man of his time. And, you know, in his time, what was happening was the transition in Europe was coming out of the Dark Ages and into the Middle Ages or the medieval times. And feudalism was becoming more kind of reified. And so people understood these kind of contractual relationships that you had between a lord and a servant on the, you know, and a vassal or something, and that you owe honor to the Lord. And if you dishonor the Lord, you got to be punished. And so it was, and then, you know, in that version of that kind of governmental structure in Western Europe evolved into constitutional Western government, which is what we have now. So that version of the atonement just kind of fits very well our understanding of how the world works.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's so fascinating just to even hear you say, like, this something came up 1,000 years after the event. It wasn't really like the predominant view that was held back then. I mean, I guess that's just shocking to me because of how many people I know believe this particular view of the atonement and the cross.
That's right. Most people do not realize that it, for the first 1,000 years of Christianity, there was another version of the atonement that was much more popular.
Okay.
And I call it the victory theory. And it says that Jesus' death was God's victory over Satan. That's what it was. So the most famous modern day analogy of that is from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Edmund eats the forbidden fruit, you know?
Yep.
Edmund eats like the Turkish delight, and the White Witch then is going to kill him.
Yep.
But Aslan is like, no, kill me instead. And so Aslan gives his life as a ransom for many, you know, wink, wink. Ah,
there you go. There
and
it
so
is.
Aslan becomes the ransom, and Edmund is released from captivity. And then in the early church, they really thought that the earth was controlled by Satan. Until God said, here's my son. If I give you my son, will you release the earth? Will you release humanity? And Satan was like, yeah, for any day, I'll take your son over humanity. So he gives him Jesus. He takes back humanity. Satan kills Jesus on the cross. And then surprise, surprise, Jesus comes back to life 3 days later.
Yeah.
Just like Aslan, you know, like the White Witch didn't know Aslan was going to come back to life.
Yeah.
So that's what was most popular the first 1,000 years of church history.
Okay. And then we see a turning point.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I mean, for that view, the victory model, I mean, are there particular streams within the Christian, whether it's denominations or Orthodox? I mean, who still maybe ascribes to that predominantly?
The most famous proponent of that view right now is Greg Boyd, who's a professor and a pastor and a theologian here in Minnesota in St. Paul at Woodland Hills Church. And he just came out with a book called The Crucifixion of the Warrior God that is not about this exactly, but it's really based on this idea.
Yeah. Okay. So
it's like the framework for his whole understanding is this spiritual warfare model that, you know, it really like, the cosmos is a struggle between God and evil, like personified evil forces.
Yeah. Okay. So with the payment model, I mean, what are the key elements that you think are, whether they're errors or like, wait a minute, we should ask some questions about this. What would you say are the ones that those questions that we should be asking about this payment model? Like what are the, I guess, problems with that particular view?
Well, I think the single biggest problem is that it most times when you hear people talk about it, it rests on this idea that people will say things like, well, God can't be loving unless he's also just.
Yeah. Oh, I've heard like, it so many times.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your response to that should be like, who says? First of all, anytime somebody says God can't, you should stop them.
Yeah.
Stop that and be like, really? You're about to tell me something God can't do or be. I thought God could do whatever God, like that's kind of, you go back to like Aristotle and Plato, the whole idea of God is that God can do whatever God wants. God doesn't have strictures on him
or
her, you know, that God can't do whatever God wants. So then to say like God is beholden to justice, God has to be just. Well, what you're doing then is you're making God subservient to a framework of justice. So God isn't really God. Justice is God, and God is subservient. So God is more like a demiurge down the kind of divinity ladder from justice. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, okay.
It's justice that's the boss, and God has to do whatever justice says. Well, then you're not worshiping God. You're worshiping like the number two, you know, or something. You're worshiping Zeus. I mean, so that's the number. That's the first thing that's very problematic. And the second thing I'd say is, if you think God is really in control of everything, then you have to think God set up this system. So God put the human beings in the Garden of Eden, knowing the human beings were going to sin.
Yeah.
Knowing they wouldn't be able to make recompense for their sin. Knowing he would have to look around for somebody else to pay for their sin. Knowing that his son was going to be the only one who would be able to pay for his sin, knowing that then his son was going to have to die as a result of human sin. So then you have to say God did kill Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, if you follow the dominoes, the first domino to fall was God started this whole thing, knowing how it would end. So then I'm just saying like God set up the system so he would have to, so his son would have to die. Therefore he is, for all intents and purposes, he is killing his son.
Well, I love even when you use the phrase in your book, when you talk about it's almost like this picture of cosmic child abuse.
Yeah.
And I mean, just that phrase alone, I mean, that paints such this really a graphic picture of who this God is. And I think it's just kind of, it's fascinating how that can be so overlooked. It's just, we just accept the kind of the company line of here's what the atonement is and what happened on the cross. And well, I guess that's just kind of it. And right. Essentially, I mean, that's my story. Like, well, this Jesus thing's really compelling and this community of Christians are really compelling. But well, if I want to do it, I guess I have to accept the fact that God really likes blood. Like he's kind of pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
And it's true that, I mean, if the Old Testament, it does seem like God likes blood.
Yeah, true.
I mean, you go back to Cain and Abel, it seems like God likes blood. God wants meat, not wheat, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know why, but that's just what God wants. God likes that more. And then Noah gets off the ark and burns, you know, makes a burnt sacrifice and the odor was pleasing to the Lord. And so you've got some other theological work to do.
Okay.
I know that. I mean, that's, for instance, exactly what one of the things Greg Boyd's new book is about. But and I do that in my book, as you know, like I spend quite a bit of time talking about Old Testament sacrifice because I think it's pretty important to deal with that.
Yeah, that was really great the way you put it together.
Thanks. But, you know, it is. Yeah, philosophically, the payment model doesn't really work. Unless you're willing to say, yeah, I guess God killed his son. I mean, God knew he'd have to kill his son from the get-go. Then, I mean, you have other questions like the questions that, you know, kids ask every youth pastors. Was there another way? Could God have saved us through an enemy?
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, I've had that one. Yeah, I've had that question.
And what were you taught when you converted in high school?
Dude, I wasn't given any other alternative. I just was like, oh, crap.
So they were like, yeah, your youth pastor would have been like, yeah, that's the only way God could have saved us, by killing his son.
Basically, yeah. There's no alternative.
That's wackadoodle. I mean, again, to say that God had to do something a certain way and God had no options, like, then God is not God. Then something else, that whatever force or being or framework predetermined that and made that decision for God, and that God then had to carry it out, that being is God. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, even if, as I think about it, I remember actually asking my first youth pastor. I did have a conversation with him. I just stopped him because I was like, you guys talk about the cross so much. And I was like, is God really that mad? Like, that wrathful? Because the way I was going to, at this time, it was a Presbyterian church. Okay. And I just, yeah, I was dumbfounded by that. Like, hold on. Like, he's that mad. And the way he's going to save the world is by one guy named Jesus. Like, let's get his blood and then we're clear. Like, I don't know. It was like, he was so wrathful and there's nothing else we could do about it. Yeah.
And your youth pastor was like, yep, he is.
Basically. Yeah. He didn't really know what to do with me at that point.
I mean, that's
well, we don't understand God's ways.
Well, that's the nice cop out too, right? Yeah, exactly. Just be like, yeah, God's ways are not our ways. And
yeah,
it's a mystery.
It's a pretty,
you just have to accept it. You just have to accept it, which then you're like, as a high school kid, you're like, really? Do I really have to accept it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now, victory model. What are the maybe a couple of the ways that you critique that and say, hey, here's some things we should ask about it?
Well, it's premised on this idea that Satan controlled the world, and that the only way God could get Satan back, get the world back, was to trick Satan. So one early church father wrote about he actually wrote a fishing metaphor that God put Jesus on a fish hook and went fishing, and Satan bit into Jesus, but got the hook, you know? And you just think, well, if God is God, why did God need to have Jesus die in order to defeat Satan? Couldn't God have just been like, Satan, you're kind of like a sticky booger. Goodbye.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Like, flick him off and be like, I'm done with you. No, he needed to go through this huge dramatic, you know, murder of execution of his son in order to trick Satan. Like, is Satan so powerful that God can't just be like, bye-bye, Satan? So I think that's a big philosophical problem with that one. And then there's just a more practical problem that, like, a lot of people, I'm not saying everybody, I mean, some people are huge fans of spiritual warfare and demons and angels battling it out in another dimension or whatever.
Yeah.
But a lot of people in a scientific age find that really hard to believe.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I vote on that one there. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, if you have a trouble with Satan and demons and spiritual warfare, then the victory model probably isn't going to be super compelling to you.
Got it. Okay. So what are some other, I mean, I don't want you to give away your entire book because you still want people to buy it and read it. Right.
Yeah.
But right. Are there any other ones that you think are worth adding to this conversation right now? Just talking about, here's another predominant view of atonement.
Well, I'll tell you that there's one in the book that I'm very fond of, although it's also got problems, and it's called the mirror theory.
I'm so glad you're talking about that one, because that one was brand new to me.
That's the one I wasn't going to talk about so people would read the book. But no, let's not. We can talk about it.
I'll delete it out of the episode.
No, it's brand new to you because it's new. I mean, it's just new. I mean, it was developed by an anthropologist who converted to Christianity just in the 20th century, very famous French intellectual named René Girard.
Okay.
And I won't go deeply into it, which I do in the book, which is this scapegoating theory that that religion is based on a scapegoating principle, and that scapegoating principle actually allowed primitive society to develop because human beings are like ontologically rivalrous against other human beings. We always earn rivalry, and people are violent. Like, people are violent against each other. And the only way early society could form was to mitigate that violence by having religion come along and say, like, hey, we're going to ritualize the violence. So you guys don't have to be violent to each other. Just, like, bring us a goat and we'll slit its throat and shed its blood. Or let's find a virgin and throw her into a volcano. Or let's lynch a black guy. You know, like, this is what religions do.
Yeah.
In order to allow society to form, is they mitigate humans' violent tendencies by finding a scapegoat and then slaughtering the scapegoat, shedding blood.
Yeah.
Like, bidding sacred violence. And then people, like, their thirst for violence is sated temporarily. And then religion does that. That's how religion allows society to form. So Girard then looks at the story of Jesus and says, well, the difference is in Jesus, he's actually a truly innocent scapegoat. And it's clear in the story.
Yeah.
Whereas in other stories, ancient stories, the scapegoat ends up being kind of guilty, a guilty figure. So the thing about the reason I called it the mirror theory is because the way I read Girard's model of the atonement, it's like God in the cross is holding up a mirror to us. So when we look at the cross, what we actually see is our own violent tendencies reflected back at us.
Okay.
When Jesus dies on the cross, we're seeing ourselves and our violence. And it's God basically being like, this is what you do to the one innocent, sinless being in all of human history. You kill it. You kill this one. And so every time you look at this cross, be reminded and convicted of your own inherent violence and turn away from it. Like, repent of your own violence. So that's why I call it the mirror theory. Other people call it the last scapegoat theory or things like that. Yeah.
So in that sense, does that mean that this is, it's a purely human event? Like this just kind of happened. It wasn't this preordained God plan from the beginning. Like,
correct.
I don't know.
I mean, the thing about Girard is he was an anthropologist. He said, I'm not a theologian. So his theory actually works with or without God in the equation.
Okay.
I mean, you could say that Jesus, you could make the whole story, he didn't think it was all human. I mean, he believed it was God. But you could make the story all human all the way down, and it still holds water. His theory does, yeah.
Wow. I wonder how many go ahead.
I mean, in some ways you can say, like, our sin nailed Jesus to the cross, but it really was our sin. It was our sin that killed Jesus. It wasn't like when people say our sin killed Jesus, what they often mean is God's so mad at our sin, he killed Jesus. So it was kind of our sin, but it's really God. But in, like, Girard's theory, in the mirror theory, no, it really was our sin. It really was our sin that killed Jesus.
Okay. Yeah, that one, I have never...
Bro, people love it.
Oh, it's, I bet they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, people hear for the first time, they're like, oh my gosh, it's so much better than the other ones that are out
there. Alternative. Yeah. I mean, okay, so then what does that mean for... I feel like in a typical kind of evangelical church, the crux is like, got to get to the cross, because then people can go, okay, now I can get saved. Like, it's that's always the thing we kind of get to. So does that reframe even how we talk in church? Like, pastors can give sermons, and I mean, how does that understanding of it, this mirror model, shift the way we just operate within the church?
Well, I can tell you that, I mean, if people want resources on that, you can do everything from, like, there are books by a guy named James Allison, who's a Catholic priest, who's written a bunch of books about Girard's theory and how it applies to, like, the Christian life. If you want to read how you might read Bible passages through this lens, you can look up a thing called the Girardian Lectionary.
Okay.
And you know, there's a there's another group called the Raven Foundation. They have a blog on Pathos, and they'll often write about current events. Like they might have they probably wrote a post today about the firing of James Comey, and about how he was scapegoated. This scapegoating mechanism is obviously super powerful, and you see in a lot of movies, you know, and a lot of novels, like scapegoating is a thing. It's a thing that happens in real life, and it's a very powerful literary device in fiction. So you can see, you start to see it everywhere, and you can then start to find it obviously in biblical texts and stuff like that as well.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful. I'll make sure to get those names and stuff into our show notes, but
excellent.
Yeah. I have a couple more questions, and I don't have a ton more time with you. So here's one of them that I've been considering. So just why is it important for us to revisit, like you said at that conference that Phyllis Tickle said, this is the next thing. The atonement is the next thing we need to really get our hands around and revisit. So why is it so important to revisit this? And how do you feel like our view of atonement affects the way we operate in faith?
I think it's a big issue right now, because in some ways it was kind of, for a long time, it was just taken for granted. This payment model was just taken for granted. It's what everybody taught. Nobody questioned it. But it's also started to kind of crumble a little bit under its own weight for a lot of people. I think that more and more people are uncomfortable with the violence that's inherent in that version. And we live in a world where a lot of us are very troubled by the violence in the world. And so any way that the very central event of Christianity seems to perpetuate violence or justify violence or give some kind of tacit approval of violence, that's really troubling for people. And I think rightly so. I think there's a rising group of Christians, even evangelicals, who want Christianity to be a peaceful religion. They've chosen pacifism, you know, as a principle. And so that's what I'd say. I think that's a big reason why. And I think you can draw a line from the payment model of the atonement and God's anger with us to a lot of bad economic policy, bad foreign policy, the rise of the military industrial complex. Truly, I mean, people might think it's kind of a stretch, but I could make that, you know, like, give me some time and I can show you, I can connect those dots for you.
Yeah, that's your next book.
Yeah. I do think that just to step back and even what it says about God, I mean, you talked about it right at the beginning of the podcast here. The idea that God is angry with us, I mean, that there are even studies that show that people who think that God is a wrathful, angry God are more susceptible to mental illness.
Wow.
It's just bad for you to think that God hates you. You know what I'm saying? It's just bad for you.
Yeah.
So if there are ways to understand the cross where there's a loving God standing behind the cross instead of a wrathful God standing behind the cross, we should at least explore those and see if they're like theologically sound and biblically sound.
Even as you say that, I literally, before jumping on this call with you, had a conversation with somebody, and he was sharing that exact thing where he felt like God hated him and was wrathful and angry. And there was, and really then he's a Christian, and he was saying, there's nothing I can do for God not to hate me. And
wow.
And that was a massive part of his own deconstruction and trying to rework some of these things for himself and still processing. And you think,
where does somebody get something like that? Well, one of the places they get it is this version of the cross.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Great. Okay. Now we're going to totally derail, and I'm going to take you a completely different direction away from the book for a second. Just because I know a little bit more of your history, like you've been pretty involved in some new ways of thinking about the church.
Yep.
And our podcast is premised on this idea that different voices are reimagining faith. So for you, as you look at where we're at in our current history, where's the church headed? Like, where's this thing going? What do you see right now?
Dude.
I know that's a huge question, but
I think the church is going toward extinction in its present form. I don't see really any signs of life or hope, at least in the global north, for the church as a force in society. I think it's going to last. I mean, there's a lot of money and buildings and clergy and things like that. So it's going to be around for another 100 years, but it's going to fade really quickly. And I think it's going to somehow reform or refashion itself. It's somehow there's going to be another way that people actively engage in Christian spirituality. I just don't think it's going to be the church, like buildings, Sunday morning worship, guitars, and a guy talking to you for 30 minutes.
Yeah. A sweet monologue.
Yeah. I don't think, like I said, it'll be around for a while, but it's not going to be around forever.
Interesting. Have you done any writing on this particular question?
Yeah, you could read my book called The Church is Flat, which is really my ecclesiology, that where I lay out kind of what I think. Yeah.
Great. Adding it to the wish list.
There you go.
Sweet, man. Well, yeah. We're coming to the end of our time. So just tell us how we can learn more about you, where we can find out more information about what you're up to.
Well, you can definitely follow me on Twitter, Jones Tony. You can like my Facebook page. Just search my name on Facebook. You can do a, search my name and you'll find tonyj.net. That's my website. Yep.
Great. Is there anything you're working on right now as far as next publishing, or you said you'd run some conferences? Anything specific there?
Yeah. I'm running a conference for Greg Boyd's organization called Renew. It's called the Renew Conference. That's R-E-K-N-E-W.
Okay.
You can come to that in September. I run the Progressive Youth Ministry Conference. That'll be next March.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's in North Carolina. Yeah. So we got a few things cooking.
No books you're working on though?
I am working on a top secret book. Ooh. I'm always writing. I'm always writing something. I am currently writing a book, but it's kind of under wraps at the moment.
All right. I'm intrigued. I will stalk your Twitter.
Good. That's
daily
what I'm
and nightly. Great, man. Well, thanks for spending some time with us today. Super value your voice and what you're doing to help us rethink a lot of this stuff. So thanks for the work you do.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, man. We'll catch you later.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of The Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.